what you want. Whoa, call him up, tell him what you want. Whoa, call him up, tell him what you want. I said, call him up and tell him what you want. Why, if you think and can't get well, oh, if you think and can't get well.
That was Uncle Lionel Baptiste, who died on this day last year. Of course, Lionel Baptiste is Tremé's Brass Band founder and leader of the Tremé Brass Band out of New Orleans, and that was Jesus on the Main Line. And just I could listen to that anytime I'm feeling down. Just put a little bit of Tremé Brass Band on, bring your spirits up, and walk and dance your way through the day. So our loss, but we have him on record. We can keep listening to him as much as we want, so that's a good thing. So, folks, let me introduce our new panel here we have with us. We're switching gears to the national and international issues of the day. We have with us Dr. John Bullock, who is professor of political science at Towson University. Good to have you back, John.
Pleasure to be here.
Baltimore City West Side activist as well.
Yes, indeed.
Good to have you here. Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist and public health consultant, assistant professor of public health here at Morgan State University. Good to have you back in the studio.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And Ann McCarthy, are you a doctor as well, Ann? I thought you were. So Dr. Ann McCarthy, dean of the business school at Hamline University in Minneapolis, former candidate here in Baltimore for comptroller, and also former assistant dean at the Hopkins School of Business, where we met. And Ann, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be back.
Good to have you here. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation, become part of this conversation today. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page. I will look at it right now. Or tweet us at Mark Steiner. And if you do jump on and send me a message on Facebook and you want to get on the air, and like Herman wrote one, and I'm going to get back to him after the show, please write a shorter piece so I can really read it. I don't have time to read long, long, paragraph-long statements because I just can't get to them when I'm on the air trying to conduct this and listen to you all as well. 410-319-8888. Three things pop out in my head about what's on the news because our guests can bring up whatever they like. As well as can you at 410-319-8888. Trayvon Martin trial. I keep calling it that. It's the George Zimmerman trial.
Right.
Yeah, really. Don't put the victim on trial.
No, but that's what's happening in some ways. So we'll talk about that. We'll look at Snowden and the Evo Morales' plane being not allowed to leave, and what that said about international world and his response to all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at Egypt, maybe look at immigration here in this country. 410-319-8888. But let's start with this thing. One of the things that this is the trial in Florida right now, and I watched pieces of it, but I don't have time, nor do I think I could stomach watching the entire thing all the time, as mm-hmm. some people do. But it's gripping this country in different ways, depending on who's watching it and how they're watching it. One of the things that I thought about this morning, reading a piece in the New York Times this morning early when I woke up, was that the judge is refusing to allow the word racial profiling to be brought up, or race to be brought up as a factor in this case. It's also where one of the experts was not allowed in from the prosecution side to testify whose voice this was. On the 911 calls and analyze 911 calls, that was not allowed in. One of the defense attorneys here before, Doug Colbert, at the beginning of the trial was saying this was not so much astonishing, but was very troubling in terms of what could come out of this case. Mm-hmm. And if the onus is on the prosecution to show intent in terms of George Zimmerman's killing of Trayvon Martin, that it looks as if the defense in some ways is eating that alive and turning that case around. And many people have fears that George Zimmerman could actually not be convicted in this trial. And that when you look at this trial as well, you see that some people are just incensed by the belittling of some of the mm-hmm. witnesses, especially Miss Jontel and mm-hmm. what happened to her on stand, Rachel Jontel. So this is, and again, we have this, people wanted to kind of bring it back to O.J. Simpson and black and white worlds viewing it differently, but this is not the O.J. Simpson trial. This is the George Zimmerman trial we're talking about. A kid, one last thing to say is that many people, especially in the African-American community, would say that if this was the other way around and if something had occurred where Trayvon Martin ended up killing George Zimmerman, we'd be seeing a very different trial and we wouldn't even be focused on what's happening in Florida, anywhere in America. Mm-hmm. So our thoughts. Anne, you want to start off?
Thanks.
Well, you're on the phone. I want to be polite. Start with you since I can't see you.
Well, like you, Mark, I listening to parts of the trial, I'm just stunned. And I think that you're right. I'm not there. I'm not in the room. And I have served on a jury. And I know that there are things that can happen that if a jury has been well selected in the jury room can really change it despite what we think is going on. On the other hand, I read the reports and see it's just astounding to me what's happening. It seems like a miscarriage of justice. I wish that this had called in, truthfully, I wish this had called into question the whole Florida stand and defend law. That's just outrageous. You can be out on the street, and not even in your own home, and kill somebody. It's just wrong. It's just wrong. But I'll leave it to your other guests who probably know more about this than I do.
I think Mark, you started off with a very interesting point, and I think it's true. And much as the case has been characterized as a Trayvon Martin being on trial, and not only we're talking about Trayvon Martin being on trial, but really talking about black manhood being on trial. You know, at what point do we start looking at young black men as being potential predators, super predators, threats, thugs, things like that? And so, you have this idea of defense, and what happens when you have someone who's unarmed, who's followed by someone who is armed, who initiates a conflict, and therefore, a death ensues. Our last panelist also made an interesting point in terms of jury selection. And so if we are going to have black manhood on trial, or particularly the idea of black men being as predators, well, it really fits into that that ethos if we have a jury that's selected of primarily white women. Right. And so if you think about those who are going to be most likely to be afraid of a black man and to see him as a potential predator. One thing that I thought was great, though, coming out of the trial, at least looking at it last week, was how they had not only Trayvon Martin's mother, but also his brother take the stand. And so what they were really doing is blowing a hole in this idea that this is some guy who's a thug, he's up to no good. No, this is a kid who was on the way to college. This is a kid who had a scholarship. This is a kid who was doing well in school. His brother is about to graduate from college. That this is a good, solid family, not the thugs they're painted out to be. So for the defense is definitely going to try to paint it out to be this, broken family, thug, type young man, as opposed to being someone who is on the straight and narrow, and whose pedigree and actually his history in terms of education, school, and troubled law is actually better than George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman has a whole bunch of other cases that had not even come to light as well. So it's going to be very interesting how we juxtapose the person who's the victim being treated as if they are the perpetrator. I thought it was also interesting how even the prosecutor or how the defense attorney under cross-examining the mother said something to the effect that, I know you would hope that your son didn't do something to contribute to his own death, even though this young man was clearly walking home in his neighborhood unarmed.
I just hope this jury can see the fact that one man was unarmed and one man was armed. I don't care how much you're pummeling somebody with your fist, it's still not shooting them with a gun.
Not only that, it's come out in the trial that there was no Trayvon Martin DNA. None of his DNA on the gun. So that right there tells me that, George Zimmerman's lying. Mm-hmm. Trayvon Martin was murdered in cold blood. He never had the gun. George Zimmerman never had a reason to be scared for his life. And he shot that boy. He was assassinated. And I think that's the, I agree with the guest. It's not only an outrage, certainly an indication of the type of history of violence that black men have been under in the history of this country. And you asked a question, Mark, about if it was the other way around, would we have this attention? I would also go further and say, if it was black on black violence, when does a black on black crime ever reach this level of, national prominence? Even though 93% of all black victims who are killed by murder or homicide are killed by other black folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's not to, as my colleague says here, that's not to put black manhood on trial, but it is to, I think, talk about the social conditions that generate and proliferate a disproportionate level of homicides that are black on black in this country.
So let me go to the phones here, where people are folks are thinking in Baltimore and around. 410-319-8888. We have about a minute or so to go to break, and Bruce, you're on the air. Bruce, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, can let me turn the radio down real quick. I'll be right with you. Yeah, sorry, I had to turn the radio down.
All right.
You know, I'm going to say some things you might not like, but I'm going to speak from the heart. Right away, from the very beginning, Trayvon Martin is a martyr. Right away, George Zimmerman is a racist. Right away, George Zimmerman is profiling this. So, you know, let's be honest about this. So here's the thing. There's a lot of information that's been kept out about Trayvon Martin's past. I listen to you guys. I hear what he was saying. But there's also a pattern of Trayvon Martin not necessarily being such an innocent kid. It's a shame he got shot, and I can understand what his parents are going through. But don't assume right away, Mr. Steiner, you're assuming that Mr. Zimmerman is guilty because he's white and he's a black teenager. I would call that bias. I would call that unfair. You assume certain things when you don't know. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's I can't believe it.
All right, well,
here's a response. I think it's important. If we want to be honest, we could say what the histories of both are, right? So some would say, look, we know that Trayvon Martin was suspended from school on an occasion. We know that there was an empty cellophane bag that may have had marijuana in it or residue of marijuana. So that was what was found. Now let's talk about George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman was arrested for domestic violence. George Zimmerman was also arrested for resisting police and interfering with police activities on two occasions, one with violence and one without violence. So this is what we're talking about in terms of those past. But again, what we have to look at is what is happening on that night, right? And on that night, we know that the 911 operator tells George Zimmerman, we don't need you to follow this guy. But we also hear George Zimmerman saying these expletives always get away, and that he takes it upon himself, and that he was taking these courses and wanted to be an officer, even though he was rejected from the police department because of his psychological profile. So we have a whole bunch of information about George Zimmerman. We also know that he called 911 over 100 times in recent months talking about similar things that were unfounded.
That was not allowed in the trial.
Right.
410-319-8888. We can take a very brief break and come right back. On our way out, you're going to be listening one more time. Treme Brass Band. To lift our spirits a bit, gonna play. I was gonna say break when you can. That's a note from my producer. Gonna play. Give me my money back.
A photograph to keep by my bed. Your picture is always in my.
That was Billy Eckstine, The Very Thought of You, one of my favorite songs, actually. Billy Eckstine's birthday is today. He was born in 1914, just set that smooth voice. And I always used to joke that Billy Eckstein, people thought he was Jewish. No, he was not Jewish. He was African-American. Could be Jewish and African-American, but no, he was not. So we are here in studio. Before we jump to that, let me remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. So before we move on, and I encourage you all to join us here, 410-319-8888, I think there's a very different perception about this trial on in terms of how people of color, especially black folks, look at the trial and how other people look at this trial. On the other hand, I think one of the biggest things when I'm watching this trial that I really, this is where the laws, especially when it comes to police officers and killings of people, no matter what city it is in America, are skewed towards law enforcement and not towards the people. And B, in the South and the West, especially, where there's, as Anne McCarthy, you were talking about a moment ago when we started, is the stand your ground, is the idea that Let me just put it on the table. I'm thinking about this. I mean, people could disagree or agree. The South was a legacy of the Confederacy and slavery and white supremacy. Mm-hmm. In many ways, a good part of the West. We forget the history of Western United States was the history of Confederate soldiers and others from the South fleeing to the West after the Civil War. Right. White folks and black folks, I'm talking about white folks in particular. And that the military and the marshal system, U.S. marshal system, were all former Union officers who came in, Union soldiers coming in to make up that world. And so that conflict has continued on through the West in many ways. And we don't talk about that sociologically a lot about where America is. And it's in these places where the stand your ground kind of laws exist, where Mexican immigrants are shot on the border, where Trayvon Martin could be shot in Miami. And that's part of this that we don't want to talk about. So we see this in purely as a legal case, whether or not you convict somebody as, for second-degree murder, am I right? Which is a very difficult thing to prove in a place like Miami, a very difficult thing to prove, period, which is why Zimmerman's defense can so handily kind of begin to eat away and destroy this prosecution's argument and go after the witnesses in this way. So it becomes this kind of legal trial on the one hand that's all about, quote-unquote, the law. On the other hand, all the other issues around this are not kind of brought in. And that's why this is the volatility of this case is so dangerous, because it talks about things the legal system can't. But there's an underpinning here that I think that says a great deal more about who we have become and what we are in the 21st century.
Right. Well, I think it is important to filter this case through our history. I think that, as a matter of fact, that's all that we can do. And that's why there is such a difference in perception between the white community and the black community, is because they're bringing history. We're bringing our history to this trial. And when we think of that history as a black man in America, we're thinking about the slave codes that over-policed black people and black men especially. We're thinking about the black codes after Reconstruction that over-policed
right.
black men, black people, and especially black men, especially the convict leasing system, sharecropping. America has always had a system of apartheid, a system of policing that over-polices men of African descent. And at the same time, gives carte blanche, gives a certain space for vigilante justice for whites who kill blacks. So we're talking about lynchings. We're talking about police brutality. But we have to remember, in this case, George Zimmerman was not the police.
Exactly.
He's a citizen. And in effect, the Stand Your Ground law gives policing powers, or gives the effect of the level of policing to regular everyday citizens. And so it allows this same sordid history to keep coming alive, because there was another young man who was murdered not too long after Trayvon for playing the music too loud.
Right.
You know, so these type of over policing of black men, that is a part of America's history and America's legacy.
Let me get a thought from Ann, and then go back to our other guests and then jump into a new subject. Ann?
Well, I mean, I agree. I just hope that the jury will essentially see the elements of this trial, which is not Trayvon Martin's background and really not even George Zimmerman's history. They're flawed individuals. It's that one unarmed man was killed and shot by another armed man. That is the essential thing going on here.
Right.
And I'm praying every night that they can see their way to that kind of judgment, because this is just wrong.
Yeah, I think
we can't. I agree with the previous. I don't know whether that was Mr. Burton or Mr. I don't know which of the two, doctor, I should say. But we can't solve the whole history of black and white in one trial. We can only hope that in this one instance, justice prevails.
No, I think everyone's right in terms of talking about, you know, the history of it, and I think some great points have been made. Even if you take it back to, you mentioned your Reconstruction, and you think about even, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, you think about, you know, books and movies like, you know, Birth of a Nation, right, that show the Ku Klux Klan is this, you know, protector of Christianity and white womanhood, which is really white vigilante justice, right? But what also happens is that those same members of the Klan wind up being parts of police forces in the South, and so there really is no identifiable, you know, break between, you know, the vigilante and law enforcement. But what's very interesting is the stand your ground piece, right? So here you have someone saying, using the idea of stand your ground. Well, what about someone who's attacked, right? What if I'm unarmed and I'm attacked by somebody? Don't I have the right to defend myself with, you know, physically, not using his firearm like Trayvon did? He was defending himself just with his hands, right? Doesn't he have the right to do that? So we think about American laws like, you know, the Second Amendment. A lot of people talk about the Second Amendment, but that wasn't always favored when it came to black men in America. So Mark, you mentioned, the West, and talked about even think about some of the Buffalo Soldiers and how there were many riots and when it came to black men defending themselves. So this is something that's not a recent issue. This is something that's been quite longstanding.
The other thing, though, is to remember that George Zimmerman is actually Hispanic, or at least half Hispanic, and I think the point, you mentioned white supremacy. The insidious nature of white supremacy is that it's ideological, so that when you have people in this country who are not white, whether racially or ethnically speaking, the danger of white supremacy is that it's so embedded in our society that other people of different backgrounds can begin to pick that up and then act out in a way that's consistent with the history, even if they themselves don't share that history through their ancestry.
Right.
Let's go 410-319-8888. Let me switch gears here and talk about a couple of things in the news. One that came to me is sort of tongue-in-cheek, but not really. I was saying this morning to Valerie as we're leaving the house, and I said, what is it about New York City? You have Andrew Weiner running for mayor, I'm a man who deeply believes in forgiveness and moving on in life and politics and every other way. But now Elliot Spitzer is running for controller,
I heard that, I was like in shock. They all believe in that Mark Sanford's good luck will rub off on them.
But what is it? But what is going on here? I mean, it's not that people should be condemned forever for acts they commit, because people can change and they learn from their mistakes. But there's something about men and power and sex and politics, period, that is a factor we don't talk about. But I just can't believe that we're seeing this kind of double resurrection, no pun intended, taking place in New York City. Anne McCarthy?
I have nothing to disagree there with you about, Mark. I really do think it's Mark Sanford, just moved north. I mean, if he can do it, they're thinking if he can do it, so can we.
And, there may be something to the Mark Sanford, comparison, in the sense that, well, what's better, at least for, at least for Weiner and to some degree Spitzer, is that what they did was not really connected to their work in office, right? So we know that, with Mark Sanford, he was gone. No one knew where he was. I mean, he left the state. So that was a bit of a problem. Whereas with Weiner, say he was doing a decent job as a congressman. He makes this boneheaded mistake. We can go make some jokes with all of this, but that it wasn't something that was affecting his political performance. So many jokes you can make with this, but I think, but in reality, I think it has something to do also with men. And honestly,
it does a lot to do with men in power.
Men in power, and you feel infallible, right? And so you feel like you can go out and do these make decisions, whether from presidents, congressmen, governors, senators, people who have made these decisions and believe they can always come back. And a lot of times they can come back. I'm not certain. That would be the case for a woman, right? I mean, I don't know if she'd be given that kind of latitude to make these kinds of extramarital, mistakes and affairs.
And again, back to over-policing of black men, would black men be given this type of ability to bounce back? We know everything about Bill Clinton, Mark Sanford, Elliot Spitzer, and the other gentlemen. So what is it about, these gentlemen that allows them to bounce back?
And
I was going to say, didn't Jesse Jackson have a little...
It's been rumored that he's had some issues. He has some bigger issues other than this. He has some federal issues that he has to deal with.
So. But
but he's not serving in office. I'm saying
not anymore.
These people who are in office,
But I think that there's something that we should explore maybe in greater depth. I think there is. We've done the show many in the past, years back, which is the issue of power, and mostly white men in power, and sex, and using in power, and what people see as sexuality and what they don't. In other words, I hearken back to my days when I was running campaigns, and I was flabbergasted by some of the men I worked with who regarded certain acts that we would consider sexual to not be sexual acts because, and that it was all right, mm-hmm. and could talk about it openly. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is something here about that is really kind of... there is an obscenity about power and sexuality that we don't want to talk about. And when I saw Spitzer's thing this morning in the paper, at first I laughed and made a joke out of it. But then it became a serious issue that we will not address this issue.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's even more serious about it is you have a lot of these men who get into political office, then want to legislate, you know, morality when it comes to a woman and a woman's right to choose, a woman's body. And so, you know, there's for instance, you know, there is a proposed law in Ohio around, you know, the usage of Viagra, and maybe some of the law should be as stringent just as it is for women to, you know, to have a right, you know, to choose to have an abortion, that there should be some legislation there in terms of receiving Viagra and all that. I mean, I think there's something to be said about men who have issues in their personal lives, but then, you know, want to legislate morality as well. I think it's very, very interesting juxtaposition.
Although these two guys are on the more liberal side.
They are.
Issues, yeah.
Okay, and they said that, and it has nothing to do with your ideological point of view. It has to do with power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whether you're right or left or liberal or moderate.
But it does speak to, even though they're politically liberal,
yeah,
on a lot of social issues, is in this country we still have to deal with patriarchal dominance and the history of sexism in America.
Oh, yeah.
Where, and looking at how we value women in this country as men, I think we've plenty of times had issues with that because they hurt their partners, the people they were with, mm-hmm. you know, and that's something that we have to deal with as well.
And
but I was going to say, having run for an office, there is something about how much people love you and care and want you to win and succeed. And I think it goes to when you're surrounded by those people all the time, every 2 years or every 4 years, it goes to your head. And I also think that running for office is packed with sort of what I would call testosterone energy.
Yeah.
You're always on a high. You're always having to go. You're always I was always shaking somebody's hand or talking to somebody. And, you know, I think it, in essence, sometimes just changes a person in ways that they don't even realize over time.
And I think that you know, I was thinking about you and as well, just because I remember when you ran and in the aftermath. I mean, and you were treated, I think, in some way, you ran a great campaign. You had a lot to say, but I thought you were treated very shoddily by both the press and by your fellow candidates who were men.
Yes.
Right?
Right. My opponent wouldn't even meet with me.
Right. And so it was like, you know, there was this, wow. and you're talking about not just somebody says, oh, I'm running, and whether you agree politically or not, was a people, whether that doesn't make any difference, was the assistant dean of a major business school in the state of Maryland running for comptroller.
Right.
Right?
Right. And my own party, well, not my own party, I actually had a lot of party support, but Governor Ehrlich wasn't really on board at the beginning at
right.
all. And he could have made a difference, and he didn't.
And I think that's the theme that you were mentioning earlier in terms of, you know, left, right, really doesn't matter that we're talking about, you know, male dominance or patriarchy. I mean, it exists in multiple forms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that the whole question of patriarchal dominance that we need to talk about in greater depth. And I have a little note from my producer here, Stephanie Mavronis, who's suggesting that. I think she's right. We need to do that. And I think that's something important to talk about. I think it's a huge issue that we ignore in terms of all the setups across the board. Mm-hmm. Let me ask another question here, another subject I want to bring up, is the Snowden case. I'm curious your takes on, A, the issues around Snowden, but also what happened with Evo Morales' plane, which was kind of shocking, I thought, from my perspective, maybe not. Anne McCarthy, what have you been thinking on this issue?
Well, first of all, it's interesting to me that he's sort of stuck in no man's land. It reminds me of that Tom Hanks movie. He can't get out of the airport because he doesn't have a passport.
But, oh, right, right.
But no matter who gives him asylum, he can't get there. But more importantly, Bradley Manning is back in the news.
Yes.
Because, and to me, those you can't really talk about those cases without juxtaposing them. One is Bradley Manning gave away really military information, you know, about troop movements and kind of what I would consider core things that could have hurt the army in Afghanistan or Iraq. Bradley Manning just gave away information about our government spying on us.
You mean Snowden?
Snowden, yeah,
right.
Sorry. This is, to me, doesn't rise to the level of what Bradley Manning did. And more importantly, this, if anything, is a true whistleblowing case. I mean, this, and it's amazing to me, most of the U.S. citizens don't care. But nonetheless, he gave him, it was nothing, I don't think, about national security. On the other hand, I do wonder if in the in that information there's something about Russia, and that's why Putin told him you wouldn't give him asylum unless he stopped leaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the challenges in America now is for people to be able to divorce themselves from the idea that everything that the government does is for your safety or for, you know, or it's going to do something for freedom or justice. I mean, I think sometimes America wants to present itself, and, you know, we're all patriots here. You know, we could present ourselves as saying we're the bastion of freedom and justice and this beacon on the hill, the shining city on the hill and all of that. But in reality, there are sometimes when the government is doing things that are not necessarily in the benefit of the people, and they require whistleblowers. And people to stand up and make this known. But if we keep but it's very useful to characterize them and say, oh, well, they did something that was a terrorist act, or it was something that opened up to terrorism. Then people, you know, sort of get in a knee jerk reaction and just say, okay, it's right to shut their mouths, to limit their ability to do this. That's why other countries are coming out and saying this. I mean, Mark mentioned Morales' plane being diverted, and now, you know, Bolivia saying, hey, we'll offer you asylum, and the fact that the other countries around the world is saying, you know, not only, you know, what America is doing to its own people in terms of spying, but what is it doing in terms of trying to destabilize other countries? What is it doing in terms of, you know, their political structures? What role are they playing in all this? So we can't always sit silent and say that, well, everything that the American government does is for, you know, for the benefit of people around the world and for democracy and freedom and justice, because oftentimes it's not the case. Now, if there is nothing, you know, to hide, you know, incidences like these really, you know, shouldn't be anything to really be feared. Now, again, the sensitive nature of information, again, I think that's something that's been debated, and it continues to be debated as well.
I mean, one of the things that's funny, Anne, because what you were describing when it comes to Manning versus Snowden, and I actually take see what your thoughts on this, because I actually look at it the other way around.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I think that most of the stuff that Bradley Manning put out, that WikiLeaks did, didn't really threaten, from what I've read, national security. Other, you know, it showed some things that maybe America needs to see around war. The other hand, I started questioning the Snowden thing from the beginning. I thought it was important that he leaked for America to see that NSA is doing domestic spying, and that's something that we're going to talk more about during the course of the week, because while it's always gone on in America, on some level or another, it's happened during war, and we don't know when this war is going to end, how deep this goes, what the information is used for, and also the connection between the government and big business and this information, how all this fits in. Those are really critical issues, and I'm glad they're on the table. On the other hand, I began to always question. We had Snowden who did this leak, but then he ends up in Hong Kong as opposed to going straight to a country where he could not be snatched, like Ecuador or Bolivia, where he could have gone too easily from Honolulu, but goes to Hong Kong instead. The Chinese use his information to say, we know now you're spying in our companies, and ends up in Russia. And so there are a lot of people, and I've talked to, not a lot, one or two, who have been guests on the show, who are former CIA operatives who thought from the very beginning something smelled a little bit different than this, mm-hmm. than it did about Manning. And what are your thoughts, Anne?
Well, I have to say, his choices of which country, I agree with you, which countries he's gone to is bizarre to me. And I have he hasn't said why he went there, or if he does, we don't know he's telling the truth. Why he did that is truthfully beyond me, unless he had friends somehow. I don't know. Why not just go to Mexico and make your way to Colombia overland? But you're right. This sounds like, you know, like a John, you know, like a novel, like a Bourne Legacy novel.
But, you know,
It does.
I have to wonder if we're doing the same thing with Snowden that we're doing with Trayvon Martin. We're putting the victim on trial, somebody who Snowden is trying to tell the truth about America. We should be pointing all of our questions at the empire that America is, both Snowden and the Bradley Manning are experiencing or have experienced the imperial reach of America as they told the truth, after they told the truth. And there's always a price for telling the truth. America is very uncomfortable. The government is very uncomfortable with people holding up a mirror, that an honest mirror that says this is what we're really doing. And I think that's what we have to come to terms with, is are we comfortable? Are we really okay with this trade-off between privacy and security? And I think the scary thing is that judging by the reaction, the level of reaction, the intensity of the reaction, most Americans are comfortable with the trade-off between privacy and security. And that's what's really scary to me.
Mm-hmm. And that is very scary. And it's also scary looking at even what's happening in terms of journalism, right? So somehow investigative journalism is somehow losing its steam. I mean, you think about, you know, even this is before, a little bit before my time, but things like, you know, the Pentagon Papers, you think about Watergate. These were big issues where you realize, well, you know what, some people in government are actually lying to you. And some of these lies actually result in deaths. And so we need to, you know, take a closer look at some of the things that are happening behind the scenes. But somehow over the last several decades, and I think especially after September 11th, people have become very fearful and so or have been willing to trade some of that, you know, some of that freedom for that, at least that feeling of security, mm-hmm. whether it's real or not.
Mm-hmm. I think we've got just too used to it. I know that Google's collecting all this information on me. So is Microsoft. So is my grocery store. So is some satellite in the sky or several satellites in the sky that the governments have put up there. And I become immune to it. Because I just don't know what to do about it, and I can't stop it. So I just think, well, it's not really hurting me right now. And it's only when it begins to hurt people that we will start to, I think, pay attention. And I agree, it's frightening.
But there also is a certain level of, when you say that, you know, you don't know what to do, I think there's a certain level of fear there for the average individual. Not only do they not know what to do, if they had some semblance of, you know, of wanting to fight back, there's the fear that America will crush you if you do that. When you look at the history, whether it's COINTELPRO and the FBI, mm-hmm. you know, America mm-hmm. has a history of squashing its own dissidents, the internal dissidents. And so there's a level of fear there that I think we have to wrestle with as well. Are we afraid of our government, or is our government afraid of us? And I think it's the former, not the latter. Mm.
Well, I mean, this has been part of this. Well, let's take a brief break and come back. We'll finish the conversation over the next 5 or 6 minutes when we come back from break before we turn to sports. So don't go away as we continue our national roundtable. You just heard Dr. Lawrence Brown here with Dr. Ann McCarthy and Dr. John Bullock. And poor little me who has no PhD. We'll be right back.
We can get you one.
Thank you.
Tonight you'll find me too weak to break the chain.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night dreaming of the sun.
Stardust, Billy Eckstein. That man, Johnny Hartman last week, we celebrated him. This week it's Billy Eckstein, the man who created crooning in America that people like Frank Sinatra and those guys became very famous for, but who was also great when he wasn't, anyway. But they were great. And so Billy Eckstein, we are celebrating him today. Stardust.
Beautiful voice.
Yes, oh my God, I love Billy Eckstein. And that was the voice of Dr. Ann McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis. Dr. John Bullock's in the studio, Professor of Political Science at Towson University. West Side activist here in Baltimore City as well. Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist and public health consultant, who has a lot to say about the east side of Baltimore and more. Assistant Professor of Public Health here at Morgan State University. And you at 410-319-8888. And before we jump into our sports segment, I just want to throw this comment out to what you all think. I said a during break to John and Lawrence, was that there was an article in the New York Times over the weekend about an op-ed about the spying they went on during the Civil War, where all the technology then was telegraph, right? So Lincoln gave it to his Secretary of War, said, okay, you can then the power to have all of the communications, every telegraph message sent anywhere would end up in this secret room near the White House. And they would go through all of the telegraphs to see who said what, where it was going in the midst of the Civil War. Now, after the Civil War, that power was taken away from the federal government. But during the Civil War, this new technology was kind of used, and so it was monitored. And that everywhere we've had, sometimes is used for some horrendous things like World War II with the jailing of all the Japanese Americans and more that happened. Not jailing, but putting thousands of Japanese Americans in internment camps. that, but that kind of overarching federal presence exists during wars because you have an enemy you're fighting and people want to know what's coming at you. Mm-hmm. You can hear that argument. What we're in the middle now, though, of is this amorphous war with no beginning and no end, with an enemy that's not declared, a constant state of emergency, it feels like, from airports to our private lives. And we're in a time when there's this very strange ascendancy, not strange at all, but ascendancy of real corporate domination of politics and power, Citizens United and more, rising on the one side, and the same kind of secretive powers of the government rising on the other in a historic moment that is fraught with dangers. I think that's what the confusion is here for people. People not sure how to handle it as citizens. And we are at a pinnacle, I think, Anne McCarthy, which is why that this moment is so critically important for us to figure out which way to go, because we could be in reality losing parts of our democracy that could be fatal to us.
I agree. On the other hand, we're also balanced by all the people who are out there on the internet now having voice through blogging and tweeting, and so there it's. We have this interesting juxtaposition between these things about increased power and coalescence of power, and yet also increased ability of almost anyone to try to get their voice heard in a medium that's not at all regulated. So I think it'll begin to happen when something about my personal life comes back to me that it, in a way that it should not have, maybe around mental or physical health issues or other kinds of privacy issues, and then we'll all begin to say, okay, this has reached a level where it's too much. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that will happen, and I think that people are too afraid of terrorism right now to care, not care, but they care on the side of safety, as you were saying earlier, rather than freedom.
Well, you talked about the federal reach, overreach, perhaps, but it's really an imperial overreach. And until we begin to really understand that America is an empire, a global empire with multiple hundreds of military installations around the world, then I don't think we really understand what's at the root of this. But another thing is that Dr. Cornel West talks about how America has been niggerized, and this is the niggerization of America. And he says that you become so scared that you defer to the powers that be and you're willing to consent to your own domination. And that's what we have here in America. We have people, most Americans are afraid of our government. We're afraid of the boogeyman that our government puts before us. When if we read people like Chalmers Johnson and others, we would understand that a lot of terrorism that we face is really blowback from America's negative imperial policies. And so it's like we create the boogeyman through our policies, then we trade our privacy for security, and now we become niggerized by our own government. That's why it's important to understand what's happened to black people in the past, because that is what is beginning to happen to white folks now.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also that connection between, you know, the message you receive. You mentioned, you know, Mark mentioned corporations before. You think about corporations, you also think about the media, right? And so what kinds of messages are you hearing? And oftentimes they're very homogenized. Even if you look at places that are left or right or supposed to be left or right, they still will tend to have similar treatment when it comes to government, right? But this is what they said. This is true. I mean, you look at the run-up to the war in Iraq. You know, there was just, you know, every outlet was saying, yes, this is the right thing to do, even though there was substantive information out there that would show you that this was an erroneous, adventure, right? But I think, you know, that corporate domination is also affecting the messages you receive, but it's also affecting how you interpret those messages as well. So we, as consumers of information, we have to also seek knowledge, seek information from alternative sources as well, and then weigh that information between, you know, historical accounts and then what we see in front of us today.
It's interesting, though, for all the information that's being collected, the Boston Marathon bombing still happened. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's not really like we're trading privacy for complete safety. And mm-hmm. and I don't know, you know, because the people who are gathering all that information, they're still boundedly rational. They can't possibly process all of it in a all-knowing context. So there's all this information, and yet I'm not sure until we have multiple kinds of machines like Watson from IBM that can almost think like a human being, then that information is really being used in a way that gives us the safety that we think we're getting by trading our privacy.
Well, you mentioned Watson. I would think the Matrix. You know, we're so plugged in. You know, when I think about the trilogy, we're so plugged in that we're at the point where we really are asleep, and we have to ask ourselves the questions. Are we in control of our technology, or is our technology in control of us?
And that's the last thought for this particular conversation. I want to thank Dr. Lawrence Brown, Assistant Professor of Public Health here at Morgan State University,
Dr.
Ann McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Dr. John Bullock, Professor of Political Science at Towson University here in Towson, Maryland. Thank the three of you for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
Always good. Thank you, Ann. Great to have you with us again.
Thanks.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about sports, the Hernandez case, but also about the Orioles. Stay with us. We'll be right back.